The topic, as Mark pointed out this morning, is really the marginalist revolution. And the marginalist revolution refers to the introduction of the principle of marginal utility into economics. Okay, independently discovered or co-discovered by three economists. Three economists, two of whom wrote books at the same time. Oops, sorry. Karl Menger, an Austrian, William Stanley Jevons, who is British, and Leon Walras, a French economist. Okay, and the dates of their books appear in parentheses. Karl Menger, the Austrian, is I gave his birth dates also. We're very, very interested in Menger, since he was the Austrian, and as I'll show you, he was the founder of the Austrian School of Economics. But let me just mention that in the case of Jevons and Walras, they did start from human beings' attempts to satisfy their wants, as did Menger. However, in their formulation of the doctrine of marginal utility, they treated utility as a mathematical or as a quantity that could be mathematically manipulated, whereas Menger applied utility, as I'll show you, to the importance that a thing had to the welfare of an individual, okay, as subjectively assessed by that individual. So Menger was much different. Was much different in developing the system of price theory or deducing it from his principle of marginal utility. Okay, it was a non-mathematical system that he elaborated, as we'll see. Let me just say a few words about Menger as the founder of the Austrian School of Economics. He basically, his contribution was in fact to create the core of Austrian economics, okay, which was the price theory that was later elaborated by other great Austrians such as Bombawerk, Ludwig von Mises, and so on. A few words about Menger's background. He was also a member of the Austrian nobility. He dropped the von in his teenage years. Most of the Austrian economists, or many of the Austrian economists of the first through the fourth generations, were members of the Austrian nobility. Okay, Eugen von Bombawerk, another member of the second generation was his brother-in-law, Friedrich von Wieser, Ludwig von Mises. In the fourth generation, Friedrich Hayek and Gottfried von Habler, all of these men were members of the nobility. They came from great families who had performed some extraordinary act or were engaged in some extraordinary activities and so on, and were knighted or ennobled by the emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So Menger, again, came from a very established family, a family that had contributed to society and so on. Now, let me just put Menger in perspective by giving you some quotations that were given by people who are acknowledged to be great historians of thought, particularly of the Austrian school. For example, Joseph Schumpeter, though he wasn't an Austrian in the doctrinal sense, was an Austrian by birth and had studied under Bombawerk, Menger's student. He said about Menger, quote, "Menger is nobody's pupil and what he created stands. Menger's theory of value, price, and distribution is the best we have up to now." And that was in the mid-1920s that he had said that. Ludwig von Mises, who knew Menger, at least at the end of his life, and was also a student of Bombawerk, who was Menger's student, wrote, "What is known as the Austrian School of Economics started in 1871 when Karl Menger published a slender volume under the title, and I'll give you the English title, Principles of Economics. Until the end of the 70s, there was no Austrian school. There was only Karl Menger." Okay. And then Hayek, who was a member of the fourth generation of the Austrian school, wrote that the Austrian school's fundamental ideas belong fully and wholly to Karl Menger. What is common to the members of the Austrian school, what constitutes their peculiarity, and provided the foundations for their later contributions, is their acceptance of the teaching of Karl Menger. Okay. So Menger was the founder of the Austrian school. Now let me mention that there was a tradition from which Menger emerged. Okay, he was a creative genius, okay, one of the greatest economists of the 19th century, certainly. Probably Bohm Bawerk was maybe more a greater economist, if anyone was. But in any case, what Menger aimed at doing was connecting the subjective values of human beings who would choose between different consumer goods with the objective prices that appeared on the market. Menger had been, in his earlier years, an economic journalist who covered the markets. And he looked around him and he saw that prices were fluctuating on the stock market, on commodity markets, day to day and even moment to moment. And he realized that the classical school, who claimed that prices were determined by costs of production, okay, at least in the long run, did not have an explanation for these fluctuations in prices. Okay, so this got him thinking about a system of economics that could explain these types of fluctuations, okay, in these cardinal numbers that we know as prices. So let's look at, before we get into Menger's thinking, okay, let's look at the classical school. Because in fact, Menger's aim was not, as many people think, to overthrow classical economics. That was not his aim. His aim was to complete what he saw as a flawed system, okay, and basically to connect the underlying values of consumers, okay, their judgments about what goods are important and how important these goods are to them, to connect those judgments and choices with the prices as determined by supply and demand. The classical school did a pretty good job of explaining how prices were determined in the market, okay, in the short run. But Menger wanted to go beyond that and show that, in fact, it was consumers that ultimately controlled prices and their movements. Now, what was the classical view of economics, okay, in particular of price theory? What the classicals said was the following. They achieved a great deal. In fact, they achieved enough in economics to be able to explode the fallacies of the early utopian socialists and to show that these early utopian socialists such as Charles Fourier, Saint-Simon, and others that Dr. Rako mentioned last night were impossible to realize in the real world because they went against these basic laws of economics that the classical school had developed. And by the classical school, I mean David Hume, David Ricardo, and Adam Smith. Okay. Later classical economists such as John Stuart Mill really just muddled up the situation more. Okay. The early classical economists were pretty clear about what they were saying. Okay. Though again, as I said, the system was flawed from the Austrian point of view. The first thing that the classical economists pointed out, very insightfully, was that prices were not determined by historical accidents, by economic power, by the whims of sellers. Okay. But they were determined by universal and immutable laws, okay? You might even call them existential laws or laws of reality, okay? And the basic law was the law of supply and demand. Okay. Secondly, what they pointed out was that prices and the allocation of resources, or rather prices regulated the allocation of resources. Okay? And they had a straightforward explanation of this, which was correct. For example, they pointed out, let's look at, you know, in today's world, the phenomenon of let's say SUVs or of low carb foods. Okay, you know, 1990 there were no SUVs. Okay, but suddenly we saw them appearing, and more SUVs being produced year after year. Now, what caused this? Okay, well, as the classical economists pointed out, as demand increased, and they didn't really explain demand, but as demand for these things increased, prices, day to day prices would rise. And that would mean that, given the cost of production of these things, profits would rise above some what they called natural level or normal level. As these profits rose, other entrepreneurs, besides the first ones to introduce them, would begin to enter into the market and produce competing SUVs. As the supply increased, prices would begin to fall. Okay? And there would be a downward pressure on profits, and they would tend back towards the normal level or the natural level. Okay, and after a while, supply would be adjusted to demand. Okay, and on the other hand, if there were, you know, the same thing explains, for example, low carb foods and so on. For a while, it's not there. You can't get it at any price. And then suddenly, you see some coming on the market, and then the market being flooded. Well, it's this profit and loss mechanism, which the classical school uncovered, the so-called invisible hand, that accounts for this. Okay, and Menger fully accepted this explanation. The third thing I want to point out about the classical economists, and Mises pointed this out, was that what they came up with was a theory of calculated action. That is, the business decision maker looked at his or her cost of production, compared it to the expected price of the good they were thinking about producing, cell phones, SUVs, whatever it was. If the prices of the output exceeded the cost of production, then they would go ahead with that. But as they did do this, as you got competition, as you had more and more producing these of these goods being produced, supply would increase or shift to the right, as we say today, and that would put a down pressure on price, and eventually the normal rate of profit would be reached, and there would be no incentive to continue to enter that industry. Okay, supply would be adjusted to demand. So it was a theory of how the businessman adjusted. It was a theory of supply. It was an incomplete theory, a flawed theory. Okay, they accepted that there was a demand out there, but they never really explained the basis of this demand. So this was the state of economics on the eve of Karl Menger's great contribution in 1871, which was the Principles of Economics. A very unassuming title. Okay, he was an unassuming man. But the book, even though it was a very slim book, literally revolutionized economics. Now, as I mentioned before, Karl Menger came out of a tradition that started with, actually even before Jean-Baptiste Say, who was a French economist, who wrote at the turn of the 19th century. And Say stressed human wants, and even before him, there was a tradition of French economists and Italian economists in the 18th century and even going back to Spanish economists, the school of Salamanca in the 16th century. Okay. They all stressed human wants. But what Menger did was to focus on concrete wants and concrete units of goods. Okay. And this allowed him, as we'll see, to develop an entire theory of human choice and of price, and to connect these human choices to prices. Okay. There were, by the way, other economists here and there, a German economist named Gossen, who developed or had an insight into what was called the law of marginal utility, which we'll talk about, before Menger did. But what they didn't recognize was that this law or principle of marginal utility was, in fact, the basis of the whole system of economic theory. Okay? And Menger he both figured the theory out or came up with the theory of marginal utility on his own, and then connected it with this other tradition that stressed human wants and came up with the complete theory of economics. Okay. One last point to make about the classical economists, though, before I go on to Menger, is that human choice does play a central role in the form of the choice of the business decision makers, okay, who adjust supply based on their calculations and expectations of the future. Okay. But on the other hand, when it came to trying to explain the long-run prices of goods, they departed from human choices, and they talked about costs of production, that somehow costs of production determined the price at which these everyday prices determined by businesses adjusting supply would tend, okay? So that was one flaw. The other flaw was that, as I said, that they left out the element of the consumer. So they were wrongly characterized as holding a theory based on a fiction called homo economicus, economizing man, meaning that everybody somehow tries to buy things as cheaply as possible and sell as high as possible. But of course, that doesn't characterize a consumer at all. Okay, that only characterizes the businessman. The problem wasn't that they believed that this was the basis of economics. It was just that they were unable to tie the consumer in a satisfactory way. So they fell back on costs of production to close their system. Now let me mention something here. This price theory that was developed by the classical economists resulted in them being unable to solve what we call in economics the paradox of value, sometimes called the water diamond paradox. Okay, the classical economists looked around and said, there's a paradox here, okay? Let's use bread instead of water. Bread is essential to human life, especially in the 19th century. Yet, its price on the market per unit of weight is very, very low, okay? So, it had a very high use value to human beings. It kept them alive. Okay? But on the other hand, it had a low exchange value or price on the market when you compare it, for example, to diamonds. Diamonds were used, for jewelry, for people who were vain or ostentatious purchased diamonds. But if all diamonds were taken out of the world, human welfare wouldn't be decreased by the to any great extent, okay, according to the classical economists. But yet, diamonds, though their use value was rather low when compared to bread, per unit of weight, diamonds were much more expensive than bread. Okay, so how to explain this paradox? Well, they didn't. They avoided it. Okay? They said, well, economics deals with explaining exchange value. We don't have to worry about use value. Yes, anything that is a good has use value. And they just put it aside. Okay? It's exchange value that we're trying to explain. Okay? So they focused on the businessman. They forgot about the consumer. And they never really solved the paradox of value. Okay? Now, this led them then to a certain theory of the value of goods. Okay? Basically, if you believe that ultimately the value of a good depends on the cost of production, okay, that is, diamonds had a high price high exchange value because it was very costly to produce diamonds, either in terms of human labor, going and digging the diamonds out. Some of classical economists held a labor theory of value, or in terms of money cost of production. Other economists held a money cost of production theory of value. In either case, the amount of labor you used or the money you spent on various inputs was very high in extracting diamonds from the earth as compared to growing bread, growing wheat that was then transformed into bread. So they were satisfied with that explanation. Unfortunately, how would you explain the value of, or how would the classical economists explain the value of old masters' paintings? Or how would they explain the value of, for example, on eBay, the lyrics, I'm a big Beatles fan. The lyrics to I Am the Walrus, the handwritten lyrics of John Lennon on the back of an envelope, sold for $40,000. Yesterday I heard it briefly. There was another lyric sheet written by one of the Beatles, and I forget which song it was, sold for near $100,000. Okay. And a few years ago, a Honus Wagner baseball card, 1910 baseball card, mint condition, sold for $600,000. So how would you explain that? Well, they said, well, there's another class of goods. Those are scarcity goods. We're only talking about reproducible goods. Scarcity goods are goods that cannot be reproduced. Okay? So therefore, well, then, yes, it's true, there is no long-run cost of production guiding that price. So what they did was they had a bifurcated or split theory of value. Okay? Scarcity goods were on one side. They didn't really talk too much about them. They were just interested in explaining the prices of reproducible goods. Okay, so that was another problem. This implied, by the way, this theory of value, that when two things were exchanged, okay, since in the long run their cost of production would be equal, they were basically equal in value. Right? So it's very hard to explain exchange in the classical framework. Okay? Because exchange implied equivalence of values. So why would anybody exchange? Well, Adam Smith had an answer. He said, well, there's a propensity to truck and barter in human beings. That is, he gave us some vague sociological illusion. Okay, could even be biological, whatever. He didn't explain it in terms of conscious human choice. Okay. Okay. Now let's get to Menger. Okay, in the preface, and I want to put up some quotes by Menger here. In the preface to his book, Principles of Economics, Menger set out very clearly what he intended to do in the book, and he did indeed accomplish this purpose. What he said was, the first quote, and this is right in the preface, "I have devoted special attention to the investigation of the causal connections between economic phenomena involving products," okay, that is the outputs of consumer goods, "and the corresponding agents of production." Okay, so he wants to know, what's the connection between consumer goods, okay, and their values, and producers' goods and their values, labor, land, and so on. Okay, "not only for the purpose of establishing a price theory based upon reality and placing all price phenomena, including interest, wages, ground rent, etc., together under one unified point of view, but also because of the important insights we thereby gain into many other economic processes heretofore completely misunderstood." Okay? So what he's saying there is that his theory is going to be causal and it's going to be realistic. He wants to explain real everyday prices. He's not interested in some long-run price that never appears on the market. He's interested in explaining, elaborating the connections between or what determines the price of consumer goods and what determines the connections between price of consumer goods and prices of land, labor, and so on. Because the classical school, when it came to distribution theory, that is to how much income laborers got and how much income landowners got, had a macro theory. They didn't try to explain individual units or the value of individual units of land, okay, or the value of individual types of labor. Okay, they just explained the division of the output among these different groups. Okay, and as we'll see, this is really the problem with the classical school. Okay, and I'll show you how Menger surmounted this problem and then solved the paradox of value and went on to explain the prices not only of consumer goods, but also of the factors of production that the classical school simply called costs of production. Okay. Menger started with an insight. This is in the notes that he was writing to himself before he wrote the book. This insight appeared especially in the French tradition, in this French subjective value tradition of the 19th century. Okay, and it predated Menger. And the biggest exponent of man being the center of the economy was Frederick Bastiat. But most of the French economists also accepted this. So Menger wrote to himself, "Man himself is the beginning and the end of every economy." Okay. He then also in these notes he wrote, "Our science is a theory of a human being's ability to deal with his wants." Again, this was harking back to the French school. So basically, all economics theory must start with human beings striving to satisfy their wants. Okay? That's the start of economic theory. Okay? That's the center of economic theory. It's not business decision makers or entrepreneurs calculating and forming expectations about future prices. That comes later on. Okay? You have to tie the two together, which the classical school had not done. Now, the very first line in the text of Menger's book is, "all things are subject to the law of cause and effect." Okay, and this was the key for Menger. Okay. What he pointed out was that in this process of satisfying their wants, you involve elements of the external world. Okay, so not only was there subjective valuations of various things, but you had to use elements of the real world around you, combine them and transform them into things that were more satisfactory to you. So you're already getting at a theory of the connection between the resources and the goods that satisfied human wants. So for Menger, there was a double causation. Human wants determined people's efforts to get the things that they wanted. So in other words, it was human wants that stimulated acts of production. Okay. So if you're alone on an island, or Robinson Crusoe is alone on an island and is hungry, his human wants stimulate him then, with the knowledge he has at hand, to go and build the net and begin to fish. Okay? So human wants cause production. But, Menger pointed out, on the other hand, once the good has been produced, the good itself causes the satisfaction of the human wants. So there's a two-way connection between the subjective and the objective. Subjective wants stimulate objective acts of production. The goods that have been produced, the objective goods that have been produced, when they are consumed, cause the satisfaction of the original wants. And in that last quote, Menger points this out very clearly. He says, one's own person, moreover, and any of its states are links in this great universal structure of relationships. It is impossible to conceive of a change of one's person from one state to another. And by that he means from being dissatisfied to being more satisfied than you were before. For example, from being hungry to having your hunger satisfied. He says, so it is impossible to conceive of a change of one person's one's person from one state to another in any way other than one subject to the law of causality. If therefore one passes from a state of need, okay, or want, to a state in which the need is satisfied, sufficient causes for this change must exist. That is, there must be good, real goods out there that are satisfying these needs. There must be forces operating within one's organism that remedy the disturbed state, okay? Or there must be external things acting upon it that by their nature are capable of producing the state we call satisfaction of our needs. Well, that's very philosophical, okay? But what he meant by all of that was simply the following. He looked at things in the world, and coming out of a tradition, a German tradition of economics, which always, it's first, the first chapter in almost all the textbooks in the 19th century in Germany, in economic theory, started with a theory of goods. Okay, and Menger's book starts with the theory of goods. Okay, and what was a good? Okay, a good wasn't a physical thing to Menger. Okay, a good was a thing that met certain preconditions. And Menger pointed out what the preconditions were. Okay, they were basically fourfold. He said, before something can be considered a good, there must be a human need, number one. Secondly, the thing must have such properties as to render it capable of being brought into causal connection with the satisfaction of this need. In other words, what he's saying is that the SUV must drive in a certain way, must have a certain capacity, seating capacity, and so on, so that the human need for this vehicle has been fulfilled. Okay? Thirdly, he said that there must be human knowledge of this causal connection. Okay, if Robinson Crusoe on his island didn't know that fish were nourishing and would fulfill his need for food, then it would not be a good. Okay, and I'll explain. We'll get into some other examples there. And four, the person must have command of the thing sufficient to direct it to the satisfaction of the need. Okay, so must have a human need. The thing that we're going to call the good must have the properties such that it will serve this human need. Human beings must have knowledge that there is a causal connection, that if I eat the fish or if I drive the SUV, my human need will be satisfied. And fourth, you must have command. That is, you must have physical control of the fish or the SUV, okay, before it can be considered a good. Now, Menger made a mistake here, okay? People do things all the time that they regret. Someone may buy a motorcycle thinking that they're going to enjoy it. It's going to serve a need, okay? And maybe he'll think he'll be more attracted to females. So he's going to drive around on this cool motorcycle. But after getting caught in the rain and a few near brushes with larger vehicles, he hates the thing and he, you know, wouldn't have paid a penny for it. Well, is that a good or isn't it a good? Okay. Or someone may ingest something that causes them to get sick. Okay, they might think that this dish, this yummy looking dish at a restaurant, is going to satisfy their need, but maybe they're allergic to something in that dish and they get sick from it. Okay, so that's still a good. They're willing to pay a price for it, as the other individual was for the motorcycle. So what Mises pointed out, he corrected this. It was a small correction. He said numbers 2 and 3, that is, the good must have objective properties that satisfy the need, and 2, people must know about them, must be replaced by one proposition, and that is that the individual must have an opinion or belief that the thing has a capacity to satisfy his or her need. Okay? And that opinion or belief, because we're fallible, can turn out to be incorrect. So Menger set out this theory of goods, which was basically correct. It needed an adjustment that Mises made later on. in fact, Menger himself actually made this adjustment without really knowing it, because he says later on, he talks about the prices paid for miracle cures that really don't work, okay? And the prices paid for the services of spirit mediums that allow you to talk to your a dead relative or something. Okay, who wants to talk to their relatives when they're alive, but when they're dead, you can avoid it. And in fact, he says, those are imaginary goods as opposed to true goods. But he's made the adjustment, basically. It's an imaginary good. You think it's going to give you satisfaction. Okay? So Menger actually, he was such a brilliant man that he did make the adjustment without really actually realizing that it was really, he sort of universally adjusted the preconditions. Okay. Now, one other point to be made, Menger went on and said, there are many things that are goods, okay, but are in superabundance. For example, the air, okay, the air is a good, okay, but the air is so abundant that it's not an economic good. There's more than enough for everyone to satisfy all their human wants for air in a normal situation. Okay? Obviously, air under the ocean or air in space is no longer what Menger would call a free good. It becomes an economic good. You have to pay to have access to air, okay? Either in a tank or generated in a space capsule and so on. So he said he defined a class of goods what he called economic goods. And they're defined as those things which are goods and for which not enough exists to satisfy all human wants for them. Okay. One other thing I do want to point out, the fourth proposition, the command of the thing sufficient to direct to the satisfaction of the need, okay, is important to keep in mind because, for example, you may need a sunny day to fully enjoy a picnic or a baseball game, okay? But you don't control the sun. So the sun is not a good, okay, in Menger's sense. All right? That's important to keep in mind. Many of the problems with so-called public goods result from ignoring that point, a very important point that Menger makes. Okay, and that was later elaborated in much more detail by Eugen von Bauwerk in his first article. Okay, so let's get to the law of marginal utility. Okay. Menger says, so we have an idea of what goods are. Now, what about the value of goods? So his second chapter goes into value. Okay, so his first chapter is on goods. And his point is as follows, or the question that he poses is as follows. What if we have a number of units of a good? Okay, now this is where he has beginning to correct the classical school. The classical school talked about bread in general versus diamonds in general, or iron in general versus SUVs in general, and so on. They didn't talk about, Menger claimed they talked about abstract classes of goods. He was interested in concrete units of goods. Okay? And you needed that, okay? You needed that insight, that people only choose between concrete units at given points in time and given locations before you can really fully explain the value of goods as determined by consumer choices. So the example that he gave to illustrate this, and this is where the law of marginal utility comes in, was that of Robinson Crusoe, or a fictional character who is shipwrecked on an island, and who has under his control a number of bushels or sacks of grain, okay? And this is pretty much Menger's example, okay? And let's say he has at his disposal 5 sacks of grain available for the full year, and that he has at least 20 wants for grain, right? So it's an economic good, okay? He can use 20 sacks, okay, as enough wants for wheat to use 20 sacks, but he only has 5 that he's harvested. And let's assume that his wants or uses for bread are ranked as follows. The most important use for grain is to bake it into bread, which will allow him to live for a full year. Okay. His second most important use is additional bread that will allow him to remain healthy and vital and to carry out other tasks, okay, and other activities. And then the third is he's going to use seed for next year's harvest so he can live another year. The fourth is grain for productive whiskey, so he has something to drink with his dinner. I think he used brandy as the example. And the fifth is feed for farm animals. Okay, there's some animals on, let's say some wild chickens and so on that he's domesticated, and dairy cows and so on. So he will use a fifth sack to feed farm animals for the year, and that will yield him meat and dairy products and poultry products. So Menger asks the question, what is the value of a sack of bread? Is its value determined by its most important use, number one? Its least important use, number five? Or some average? Okay. Now remember, they are exactly the same, they're identical. And each sack of bread, we're assuming, can fulfill any of those 5 needs or wants for bread. So what Menger did, which was brilliant, was to perform the following thought experiment. He said to the reader, now suppose that I lose one of those sacks of bread. Let's suppose I lose the second sack of bread, that I have them stored in a shed, I'm about to start using them at the beginning of the year, and a fox breaks in and devours the second sack. Okay? Do I go without the second output or amount of bread that I could produce from that sack? Okay. Well, he says, of course not. Of course not. What I go without, what I forego, or what I sacrifice is my lowest valued use of the bread, which is feed for farm animals. So no matter which sack disappears, what satisfaction depends on that sack? He called it dependent satisfaction. He did not use the word marginal utility. That phrase in German, Grenznutzen, was coined later by Friedrich von Wieser, one of his followers. Okay. So the dependent utility, or we call it the marginal utility, is what you lose if you lose any one of the units of the supply in your possession. So there's concrete units, there's concrete needs that they serve. So what Menger pointed out then was that the value with a supply of 5 units or 5 sacks of grain, the value of a unit is equal to what? The lowest ranked satisfaction that a person can serve or will be served by the supply, okay? And that's the fifth ranked use. So that is the marginal utility, okay? The last satisfaction that is given by the concrete supply of the good. So Menger pointed out then that let's say that you do have a loss of one of the 5 sacks of grain. Now you only have 4. Now what happens to the value of the good? Now you get the law of diminishing marginal utility. Okay? With 4, the value of each sack is higher. Right? Because now a more important want, a want for whiskey, depends on losing one of those sacks. So, The lower the supply, the higher the marginal utility, and therefore the higher the value of each unit of a good. Right? The greater the supply, if somehow he finds five more units, or five more sacks, and now he has 10, then the marginal utility and the value of the good is lower. Because now it's the 10th want that has to be given up if one of those sacks is lost. And of course this explains and resolves the paradox of value. Because if we perform the thought experiment of someone stranded in the desert who hasn't had water in 3 days and has a perfect diamond in his pocket, let's say that $12 million purple diamond that Kobe Bryant bought for his wife to make up for his infidelity. That was costly. Even if you had that in your pocket, okay, and someone has a gallon of water, okay, which is going to keep you alive for 3 more days. I don't know how long you can go out. Let's assume it's 3 days. Okay, would someone exchange this perfect diamond for the water? Well, of course, because in that situation, water is so scarce that a more important want depends on having that gallon of water than depends on that $12 million diamond that you have in your pocket. Okay, in a normal situation, water or bread is so abundant that the marginal utility is lower than the marginal utility of diamonds because they're so scarce. Okay. So that's how Menger, by focusing on concrete units, individual human choices, concrete wants, that's how he came up with the theory, really, of human choice and value of consumer goods. Okay. So really what is valued is not the good itself. Okay. As wrongly thought by the classical school, it's the service that the good provides in satisfying wants. The classical school thought that value went from the factors of production, land, labor, etc. If they were expensive, well, then the good itself has to be expensive. Okay? But really, it's the other way around. That is to say, if the good serves a very important want, if it has a high marginal utility, therefore people are going to be willing to pay high prices for that good. And through the interaction of the market, the prices will be high. So there is no paradox. Diamonds have a higher price than bread in normal situation, as I said, because the marginal utility of diamonds to most people are higher than the marginal utility of bread. Were that not the case, you would get a reversal of their value. Okay, usually when I teach this to undergraduates, this was a while ago when I was using this particular example. You can think of a situation where everyone adopts the same types of values as the Amish people do in southeastern Pennsylvania. If you saw the movie Witness with Harrison Ford, okay, the Amish people dress very plainly. They even think that having buttons is ostentatious. So they have hooks and eyes and hooks or something instead of buttons. So they don't, and of course they don't wear any jewelry whatsoever. Now what if all Americans adopted that particular set of values? What would happen to the value of diamonds? Okay. Well, they would fall to zero. And as a result, what would happen to the wages of highly skilled jewelers? That would fall to zero. And what about diamond mines? Forgetting about the industrial uses for a moment. That would fall to zero. So it's not because diamond mines are expensive and the services of jewelers are expensive that diamond jewelry is expensive. It's the other way around. It's because diamond jewelry has such a high price because it serves such a highly valued want that the factors of production that go into producing it have high values. And even before Menger wrote, there was a French economist and philosopher, Condillac, who made the observation that pearls are not expensive because men must dive to very great depths to get them. Men dive to very great depths to get pearls because they're so valuable, okay? Because they believe they're so valuable, okay? So it's not, in other words, you incur very high costs because the value is high. So basically then, what we can say is that we call Menger's theory of, principle of imputation. Okay, production goes from, as we'll show you in a moment, from the factors of production from land, labor, and so on, production moves downward towards the consumers. But value moves upward, okay? Let me just give you another example of marginal utility just to make sure you understand the principle, and then we'll get to how the factors of production are valued. Mm-hmm. Let's say there's a farmer. This is B. And this farmer has 3 horses and 2 cows, and we're going to assume that these animals are not interchangeable. Okay, the horses can only serve certain uses, and the cows can serve other, different uses. Okay, let's assume that the farmer now possesses 3 horses and 2 cows, and that the his scale of values regarding the use of these animals is as follows. Okay, which is the more valuable animal, the horse or the cow? Well, the horse serves the two most important wants on his value scale. Okay, but yet the horse is the less important value. Because if the barn's on fire and you can only save 4 of the animals, which animal is you going to leave in the barn? The one that serves the least or the lowest valued use, which is the third horse, which he uses for pleasure riding. Okay? So in that, so we see there that the horse has a lower value despite the fact that it's at the top. It's like water and diamonds. You know, obviously water serves the most important needs for a human being. But the fact that it's so abundant means that its marginal utility is lower than diamonds. Same is true here with horses and cows. Now, if that changes, if he loses that horse, the more important animal becomes what? The horse, right? So, as your supplies of goods are changing, the values you attach to them are constantly changing. Okay. I have a teenage son, or actually he's 20 now, but we have 3 cars in the family, and assuming they're pretty interchangeable, though I have a nicer car than him, but let's assume I crack my car up, okay? Well, do I do without the car? No. I mean, we reallocate it to the highest valued use, which is me. So Junior, you know, he loses the car, okay? Because I set the value scales in the household. Well, in consultation with my wife. So that's the... okay, so, but then with only 2 cars, obviously then, the value of the cars to the family goes up because the marginal utility is higher. Now with 2 cars, your lowest valued want is higher than with 3 cars. Okay, the lowest valued want served by the supply. Okay, what I want to show you now, and I actually didn't draw this too well, I meant to put it on here, is how Menger explained, using this framework, the value of what he called higher order goods. Okay, the lower order goods are the consumer goods. That's the lowest order good. Okay, or the first, what he called the first order good. Second order goods are the goods that directly are involved in producing the first order goods, and so on. Maybe I can put this up here. I don't know how well it'll show. I meant to type it up, but. Doesn't show too well, but let me just point out to you what I'm looking at here. Okay, we're talking about the first order is the bread at retail, okay? Bread that's bought at retail. Okay, now, the value of that bread, okay, is imputed, and the word that the Austrians use is imputed, okay? Imputed directly back to the value of the flour, the ovens, the baker's labor, and the trucks. So if the bread sells for, and you can think of this in Robinson Crusoe terms, But if the bread sells for, let's see what happened here. How do I make that clearer, Chad? It was clear before. I hit something.
Take it off and put it back on and see if that works.
Well, it doesn't work that well. Okay.
Zoom?
Yeah, maybe zoom. There you go. Perfect. All right. Yeah. So if the bread sells for $100,000, then forgetting about interest for the moment, the value, the total value of the flour, ovens, bakers, labor, and trucks is $100,000. Why? Because they cause, in Menger's causal realistic theory of price, they cause the production of the bread, bringing them together. Okay? So production, you see the downward arrow, production runs downward, okay, from labor, iron ore, mining implements. Okay, you need all of those to produce the machinery and so on for the farm tools, okay? Then you bring together in the fourth order land, farm labor, farm tools, and that gives you the wheat, the wheat you combine with a mill and miller's labor, and that produces the second order good, which is the flour, which is then combined with ovens and baker's labors and trucks. So what I'm pointing out is that the value goes upward. It's imputed from, not the bread itself even, but from the service the bread gives a consumer in satisfying his or her wants. Okay? It's imputed upward to the second order goods, okay, which bring about the production of the bread, and that's imputed up to the third order goods, and so on. So the classical school started up at the top and said, well, people work very, very hard, you know, to produce this stuff, and therefore there's some value that comes from the higher order goods and results in, if it's diamonds, for example, the value of the first order good is very high if there's a lot of cost of production. Okay, but Menger said, no, it's the other way around. Production moves downward towards consumer, value moves up, back, upwards through the various orders of goods. Whereas the classical school had both arrows coming down, value and production moving in the same direction. But if value moves down, then it's not subjective, it's objective. It's determined by the objective quantities of goods that you're using. One historian of thought mentioned that the classical school believed that the more you sweat onto a good, the more labor sweat that fell onto a good, the more valuable it was. Somehow, labor infused the good with value. Okay? And so the more sweat there was involved in producing the good, the higher the value. That's not true. Okay? As we saw, marginal utility determines the value of a good. Consumers collectively determine the value of a good. Okay? When confronted with a certain supplies of different goods on the market. Okay? So that's Menger's law. Menger's law is that the value of the means is determined by the value of the ends. That is, the value of the resources are determined by the value of the first order good, which in turn is determined by the marginal utility of that good to consumers, okay? Or the interaction of their marginal utilities on the market. But now, what we haven't explained, by the way, is, well, how much is flour worth? How much is our ovens worth? What about baker's labor? How are these prices determined? If you can only impute the total value of the bread back to the second order, how do you determine the individual or the values of the individual units of these factors of production? And again, Menger came up with a creative solution to this, and pointed out that there is something that is like marginal utility operating to determine the value of specific producers' goods. And let me just give you an example that he used. Here. Or actually an example that I came up with based on his discussion. Okay, and let me just use something new here. Let's say that someone is going to produce 100 sacks of wheat. Okay, 100 bushels of wheat, let's say. And this is the production function, that this farmer needs 90 days of labor, 90L, plus two horses. Okay, so the service of two horses for the year, plus one plow, so 1P, plus, let's say, I don't know, 40 acres of land, plus 500 pounds of fertilizer. Now, all of that will equal 100, well, will bring about the production of 100, let me hit something again. There we go. 100 bushels of wheat. Now, if I were to ask, what's the value of 100 pounds of fertilizer, 100 weight of fertilizer? Okay, how do we answer that? Okay, how do we know what the value is? All we could say is that it's whatever the value of the 100 units of wheat is to the consumer, okay, let's see, this is Robinson Crusoe, okay, then that is the value of all of those various factors in total. That's your total value. Okay. Again, abstracting from interest for the time that is weighted, that must be endured while the production process is underway. Well, Menger, again, posed a very, very insightful question. He said, what would happen to the amount of wheat produced if we took away 100 pounds of fertilizer? Okay. Because he pointed out, most production processes are not like chemical reactions, whereas where you need, for example, two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen to form a molecule of water. Okay, if you had three atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen, you wouldn't get any more water. Or if you subtracted one atom of hydrogen, you wouldn't get any water either. Okay, so that's called fixed proportions. Okay, that is that in producing goods, fixed proportions of factors are used. That's very, very infrequent. In most cases, you can produce goods in many different ways. Okay, you can use, for example, you can produce a car by hand, okay, as they did at the turn of the 20th century, or you can produce it as it's produced in America, okay, with many machines, but also a lot of labor, or you can produce it as they do in Japan with a completely robotic factory. Okay, and very little labor, just a few guys running computers controlling the robots. So there's many different ways to produce most modern industrial goods. Which means this: if you take away some fertilizer, you're not going to lose all your wheat. You're going to lose some of the wheat. So let's say I subtract 100 pounds of fertilizer. Okay, so now there's 100 pounds less of fertilizer, and I observe that 100 pounds of fertilizer results in minus 7 bushels of wheat. So in other words, I now only get 93 bushels of wheat with the same combination but with 100 pounds less of fertilizer. Okay, yeah, I'm at the end. So what Menger pointed out was simply this, that the value of the 100 bushels of wheat is equal to the marginal utility of 7 bushels, or let's make this 10 to make it easier. 10, you know, reduce the amount of wheat by 10. The marginal utility of a unit of 10 sacks of wheat. Okay? Now, Menger never went beyond this to the market, but let's assume that this guy is going to sell this wheat on the market. If wheat sells at $3 per bushel, okay, well then, the value, what he would pay for the 100 pounds of fertilizer is 10 bushels of wheat that he loses by not having it, times the $3 per bushel of wheat, okay, because you'd get a reduction of $3 in revenue for every bushel you don't produce, so he'd be willing to pay up to $30. Okay? And you can do that with all of the other factors, as long as they're used in other production processes and there's other entrepreneurs bidding for them. The last thing I wanted to point out very quickly is Menger's theory of exchange. He said Smith was wrong. He comes out and says Smith was wrong to assume that there's a propensity to truck and barter in human beings, and that explains exchange. Okay? To give you a very simple example, Menger said exchange takes place whenever there's a reverse valuation of the goods exchanged. So if A and B meet, and A has a horse, and B has a cow, and A prefers the cow to the horse, and now I'm putting it in parentheses because he doesn't possess it at the time, and B prefers the horse to the cow, obviously they both have a reverse valuation. A prefers what he doesn't have to what he has. B prefers what he doesn't have to what he has, so he's certainly willing to trade the cow for the horse. In that way, each one improves his welfare, Menger pointed out. And that is the explanation for exchange. There's mutual benefits from exchange. That's why people exchange. So whenever you purchase anything, okay, if you go out and purchase a newspaper, it means that you value the newspaper above the $1 you paid for it. The seller values it the $1 above the newspaper, which means that there isn't any equivalence of value between goods exchanged. Okay, in fact, exchange always shows a double inequality of value between the goods exchanged. Neither party values these goods in the same order. Okay? Each one values what he gets more than what he gives up, or he would not make the exchange. Okay? And so that was Menger's theory of exchange, and we'll stop there. Thank you.